Hello, and this is Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. I'm Laura, and for today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with Professor Stephen Gordon from the University College Dublin. Professor Gordon specialises in tuberculosis research in both people and animals. So, to get started, Stephen, please could you introduce yourself?
My name is Stephen Gordon. I'm a professor in infection biology in University College Dublin, where I'm based in the School of Veterinary Medicine. And our research is focused on the bacteria that cause tuberculosis in mammals. And that's really Mycobacterium bovis, which is the main causative agent of tuberculosis in cattle and wildlife. And then Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which is the main cause of tuberculosis in human populations. And basically what we try to do in our research is using tools of genetics and genomics of those pathogens to try to understand how those bacteria work as pathogens. So how do they cause disease? And by understanding how they cause disease in humans and animals, we hope to be able to develop new control strategies to ultimately control tuberculosis in animal and human populations.
What inspired you to research bovine tuberculosis and tuberculosis in general?
I first started researching tuberculosis when I was an undergrad student in University College Galway. In third year, we were asked to do an essay on tuberculosis. I started investigating tuberculosis for that essay and was fascinated by the idea that to me, this was a disease that was something from the 19th century. And it was reading about it back in the 1980s that I realized that it was still very much a real and present disease globally. And then based on that, then I actually then went off to do a PhD in tuberculosis at the University of Leicester. And in that, we were trying to understand, first of all, how does Mycobacterium tuberculosis develop resistance to the drugs that we use to treat TB? And also, how does the bacteria respond to different stresses in the environment? So how does it alter its gene expression so that it can survive better in response to various stresses that the immune system might put it under? That was in the mid-1990s when the field of genomics was really starting to emerge. And in 1995, there'd been the publication of the first complete genome sequence of a free-living bacteria, that was Haemophilus influenzae. And Stuart Cole's group at the Institut Pasteur in Paris were applying those tools of genomics to Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So I was really lucky to be able to do my postdoctoral research in Stuart's lab in the Institut Pasteur in Paris, where we were applying those tools of genomics to decipher the genome sequence of Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And from that, see all of those genes that were involved in virulence, drug resistance, and really get that first insight into what makes the pathogen tick. And to me, that was, I tried to sequence a kilobase of DNA during my PhD in Leicester. That was in Peter Andrews' laboratory, and it was so difficult to do. And then to compare that to a few years later, being able to sequence large tracts of DNA in collaboration with the Sanger Center, as it was then in Cambridge, and then to get that genome sequence basically as a download from the Sanger Center, and then start to look at that genome sequence and annotate it, add the functional capacity that that piece of DNA was encoded, was just, it was absolutely incredible. And so that really switched me on to the power of genomics. And then after that, in Paris, I moved to the UK to the Vet Lab Agency to basically apply the same kind of approaches to Mycobacterium bovis. And that was in the group of Glyn Hewinson. And again, that was a really exciting time. We sequenced the genome of Mycobacterium bovis for the first time. And then we also started to use that information both to develop improved diagnostics for Mycobacterium bovis with Martin Vordermeyer and his group at the Vet Lab Agency. But then also trying to use those emerging genome sequences to start to try to understand what does the genome sequence of Mycobacterium bovis tell us about the way that Mycobacterium bovis has evolved, and how does that fit into what we think about the evolutionary scenarios of Mycobacterium tuberculosis?
And what did you learn from all this research on the genomes of Mycobacterium tuberculosis and Mycobacterium bovis?
Back when I was researching my essay back in the 1980s, the idea was that tuberculosis in humans arose from tuberculosis in animals. So when humans first domesticated cattle, they came into contact with Mycobacterium bovis. And in doing so, Mycobacterium bovis kind of jumped the species barrier and adapted to humans and became Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And that was the kind of scenario that we thought was the case for many years. But when we first sequenced those genome sequences of Mycobacterium tuberculosis and Mycobacterium bovis, we realized that, in fact, that couldn't be the case, because the genome of Mycobacterium bovis had lost regions of information that were actually present in the human pathogen. And in fact, it made us realize that, no, in fact, both of these pathogens have obviously arisen from a common progenitor, but that the genome of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, of modern or current isolates of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, is more similar to that progenitor than Mycobacterium bovis is. So it really kind of turned our thinking around. So, you know, when we think about the evolution of these bacteria, certainly we don't think anymore that Mycobacterium tuberculosis has evolved from Mycobacterium bovis. Instead, they've both evolved from some common progenitor bacteria, probably a soil bacteria that over many millennia evolved to adapt to the mammalian host and cause tuberculosis.
We know that Mycobacterium tuberculosis is a major human pathogen, but Mycobacterium bovis infects primarily cattle. Both of these bacteria are seen all around the world. What are the symptoms of Mycobacterium bovis infection, and what impact does this disease have globally?
Really causes a serious disease in cattle. It affects the lungs largely and the draining lymph nodes. It would cause drops in milk production. And then also when those animals would go to slaughter for meat production, you'd identify carcasses that had evidence of infection and pathologies. Of course, they would then be condemned and removed from the food chain. So both in terms of protecting public health, but also in terms of protecting animal health and welfare, and also market access for products from dairy products or meat products, we need to be able to control bovine tuberculosis in cattle. And the way that we do that is by testing cattle annually. And that's usually the way in the UK or Ireland, so that all animals will be tested annually for evidence of infection. And those animals that show evidence of infection are then removed from the herd, so they're slaughtered to stop that transmission cycle. So to stop any animals that show evidence of infection from then progressing further, such that then they'd shed the Mycobacterium bovis and transmit that infection to other animals in the herd, but also, of course, to stop that infection spilling over into the human population.
What kind of control measures are in place to prevent the spread of Mycobacterium bovis between different herds of cattle?
Yeah, so the key measure that's in place to control bovine tuberculosis in, let's say, the UK or Ireland would be a diagnostic test that's called the single intradermal comparative tuberculin test, or sometimes just abbreviated to the tuberculin test. And the idea of that test is it uses antigens from Mycobacterium bovis and a related mycobacterium, Mycobacterium avium, as a way of trying to identify animals that are specifically infected with Mycobacterium bovis. And in many parts of the UK, so areas where there's a high risk of infection, animals would be tested annually. In Ireland, all animals would be tested annually to identify animals that are potentially infected with Mycobacterium bovis. Once that happens on a herd, then the herd basically goes into a lockdown, the same as what's happening to us now with COVID-19. So to prevent the infection potentially moving from that herd and spreading to another herd. So the herd goes into a lockdown, and then the herd is retested again until the herd is defined as being clear from any animals that are potentially infected with Mycobacterium bovis. And once the herd is determined to be clear from infection, those lockdown restrictions are then released, and then animals can be traded again or moved off the farm. So that's a way that we try to detect infected animals. The herd then gets locked down to prevent any potential infection leaking out of the herd. And then those restrictions aren't removed until we think all the potentially infected animals have been identified and removed from the herd.
And the tuberculin test is carried out by qualified veterinary professionals. It's quite a challenging test to read, as far as I understand, because it's based on skin inflammation. So for those with a larger number of animals on their farm, to test the whole herd can take several days. Are there any other tests or alternative options in the pipeline?
Yeah, so the tuberculin test would be the cornerstone test that's used to detect animals that are potentially infected with Mycobacterium bovis. So then there's an ancillary test as well that's called the interferon gamma test. So that's different from the tuberculin test. So as you said, the tuberculin test is a skin test where a veterinarian will inject a little bit of antigens from Mycobacterium bovis and Mycobacterium avium, and then wait, and usually about 72 hours later, come back and then measure skin thickening. And then based on the way that the skin has thickened or swelled where those antigens have been injected into the skin of the animal, the animal is then classed as a reactor or not. So the other test that's used as an ancillary to the tuberculin test is this interferon gamma test. And that's a blood-based test. So by that test, the idea is to take a blood sample from the animal, and then that's shipped back to a lab. And ultimately, the idea is kind of the same. You take the blood sample, and then you expose it to antigens from Mycobacterium bovis or Mycobacterium avium. And if the animal has previously seen Mycobacterium bovis, it will have circulating immune cells, T cells, in that blood sample, which, when Mycobacterium bovis antigens are present, will specifically react to that by producing interferon gamma. And so we always use that comparator test of Mycobacterium avium as well, because we know that we have lots of mycobacteria out in the environment which are similar to Mycobacterium bovis. So we need to be able to make sure, is that antigen response specific to Mycobacterium bovis, or is it a kind of a more general, just mycobacterial response? And so the Mycobacterium avium reaction is a kind of a negative control in that regard. So a blood sample is taken, exposed to Mycobacterium avium, and then you see, is there a greater amount of interferon gamma produced in the blood that's stimulated with the Mycobacterium bovis antigens as compared to the Mycobacterium avium antigens? And if there is, again, you can class those animals as being reactors. And the interesting thing about the interferon gamma test is that it's a little bit more sensitive than the tuberculin test. So the tuberculin test is a fantastic test in terms of its specificity. So it's got a very low number of false positives. But sometimes what we miss are the animals that are truly infected in the herd. And so when we're really trying to remove infection from a herd, what we'll sometimes do is go in and use the tuberculin test as the first kind of sweep through the herd. And then if we really want to start to be able to remove all of the potentially infected animals, the interferon gamma test can be used as a backup ancillary test to try to identify all of those animals that are truly infected. And so by combining the interferon gamma test with the tuberculin test, what you're hoping to do is identify the maximum number of truly infected animals that are in the herd, and therefore remove all those infected animals from the herd.
And does having that extra test allow for lockdown on farms to be lifted more quickly?
Yes, so ultimately, of course, what you want to be able to do is make sure that the farm is locked down for the minimum amount of time possible. So exactly like you say, what you're hoping to do with these combination of tests is to identify the maximum number of truly infected animals and remove them from the herd so that, exactly like you say, so that as quickly as possible, that farm can go back to having the lockdown released and then being able to trade normally.
It must be a hugely stressful experience for farmers to have their farms locked down and essentially their livelihoods put on hold for an indeterminable length of time.
Absolutely. It's absolutely hugely stressful for farmers. So, for example, in Ireland, the average period that a farm would be locked down for after you'd identify an infected animal in that herd would be around about 150 days, but it could be more or less. So you can see the stress that that puts farmers under, both in terms of the lockdown, but also in terms of the removal of their animals, which are deemed to be reactors to the skin test. So they could be animals that have particular high genetic merit or, you know, that have particular value to the farm. So it's a hugely stressful experience for the farmer to be, first of all, locked down, but also to have high value animals being removed from the herd and slaughtered.
More after this.
The Society has launched its first fundraising initiative to help members to progress and to reach their full career potential. The fundraising appeal will generate funds to underwrite a new grant, known as the Unlocking Potential Grant. The Unlocking Potential Fund will be available to early and mid-career members who may require an extra level of support to help them deal with a situation that threatens to hold them back from achieving what they could. Everyone faces a career challenge at some stage. Even knowing which career step to take next can be difficult to navigate. Help support the microbiologists of the future, who might in turn one day provide solutions to global challenges and help them reach their full career potential. Visit microbiologysociety.org/unlockingpotentialfund to find out more.
We have a vaccine for Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the BCG vaccine. Is there a vaccine for bovine tuberculosis?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. So the, as you say, so the vaccine for tuberculosis in humans is BCG, the Bacille Calmette-Guérin. And the interesting thing about that is that BCG is derived from Mycobacterium bovis, from the animal pathogen. And it's an interesting story in terms of how that vaccine was derived. So basically, Calmette-Guérin at the Institut Pasteur in Lille were doing experiments into the pathogenicity of Mycobacterium bovis. So how does Mycobacterium bovis cause disease? And they were orally infecting animals and seeing if an oral infection could result in disease in the lungs. And they noticed that, in fact, that did happen. But to get their experiments reproducible, they noticed that they had to make sure that the suspension of Mycobacterium bovis that they were using needed to be really fine. And so to do that, they used a detergent. The detergent was basically ox bile. So by using ox bile in their media, they were able to make nice fine suspensions. But what they noticed was that after cultivating the bacteria in that media for a number of passages, they noticed that the virulence of Mycobacterium bovis was reduced. So they'd almost stumbled across a way, serendipitously, to be able to weaken the virulence of Mycobacterium bovis through in vitro passage. And of course, that was exactly the method that their mentor, Louis Pasteur, had developed for other infectious diseases, the idea of taking a pathogen, growing it in vitro in the lab, and by growing it in vitro, it would reduce its virulence such that now you had a variant of the pathogen that was weakened or attenuated, and that inoculation of animals or humans with that weakened variant of the pathogen would generate an immune response, which would be ultimately protective when the human or animal was challenged with a virulent pathogen. So what Calmette and Garand did, therefore, over 13 years was basically to repeatedly passage Mycobacterium bovis in vitro, until in 1921, they basically ended up with this strain, the Bacille Calmette Garand, the BCG vaccine, which we use today. And so BCG is one of the most widely used vaccines in the world, but it's the only vaccine that we have still 100 years later for tuberculosis. And it's the only vaccine we have not only for tuberculosis in humans, but also in animals. And so over the years, there's been a lot of interest in seeing, could we use BCG as a vaccine in animals? So, and that's taken on, I suppose, two different sides. One is, can we use BCG as a vaccine in cattle? Or can we use BCG as a vaccine for wildlife? So, for example, badgers. And so if we look at cattle, first of all, the difficulty in using BCG as a vaccine in cattle is that cattle that are vaccinated with BCG will then come up as looking as though they're positive when we use the tuberculin test. So now, inadvertently, we won't be able to distinguish whether an animal is infected or vaccinated. And of course, that will then take away a cornerstone of the control strategy, namely the specificity of the tuberculin test. So over many years in research, which has very much been driven by researchers in the Animal and Plant Health Agency, so Martin Vortemeyer and Lynn Hewinson and colleagues, they've developed sets of antigens which are specifically able to differentiate animals that are vaccinated from those that are infected, so so-called DIVA diagnostic tests. And so that's a really exciting development, because that means that now you can actually envisage the use of BCG as a vaccine in cattle. And if we look across a lot of experimental studies that have been done, what we see is that vaccination of cattle with BCG does offer some level of protection. And in fact, now that we have a potential differential diagnostic, now in the UK, field trials are hopefully starting to roll out to look at the efficacy of BCG in cattle in terms of its ability to protect cattle against infection and disease from Mycobacterium bovis. And then if we look on the other side, the flip side would be in wildlife, and particularly in badgers. And there have been a number of, again, different trials looking at the use of BCG as a vaccine to protect badgers. And notably, there was a trial done in Ireland a number of years ago, led up by Eamon Gormley. And in that trial, what they did was they looked at a particular county in Ireland where they did a placebo-controlled vaccine trial using BCG in one group of animals and using a dummy vaccine in another group of animals. And what they showed over the three-year course of that experiment was that animals that were vaccinated with BCG, so badgers that were vaccinated with BCG, were less likely to seroconvert, to show signs of infection, basically. So the BCG did offer protection against M. bovis infection, probably around over 80% protective efficacy. And that result is so promising that as of 2018, BCG vaccination of badgers is now part of the national control strategy for bovine TB in Ireland. So We do culling of badgers in particular areas currently. But what the hope is that we can remove culling as part of the control strategy of badgers and instead replace that with vaccination over the next number of years. So I think that's a really exciting example of how we can use vaccination to try to increase our toolkit, basically, as a way of controlling bovine tuberculosis in animals.
That's really exciting, but I guess catching and vaccinating badgers is a little more challenging than vaccinating cattle.
Exactly, yeah. You've got to, so the trial that was done basically was catching badgers in cages. So and that's the reason for that is that's the way that they're caught when they're culled. But basically you have a system in place that's catching those badgers, and instead now rather than culling them, well, why not vaccinate them? So that's the idea, to remove culling and replace it with vaccination. So, you know, I think it's a real positive news story, I think.
I would love to hear about the work that you and your colleagues at the University College Dublin do. I know that you've been looking at a One Health approach to tuberculosis elimination. What exactly does that look like?
One of the key things that we do in our group is to really apply the principles of One Health to our research. So One Health is about the interaction of human, animal, and environmental health. And I think tuberculosis is a real paradigm in that regard for exactly the reasons we've spoken about. It's a disease that affects humans, animals, and wildlife. And we really need to be able to develop ways to control infection in animals in a sustainable way to stop that infection moving into humans. But we also need to be able to develop ways to control tuberculosis in humans. Tuberculosis in humans still exacts an enormous burden on the human population. So somebody dies of tuberculosis approximately every 20 to 25 seconds globally. So that's 1.4 million deaths and 10 million new cases every year. And those numbers have been like that for decades. So we desperately need to develop new ways to control tuberculosis in humans. And so our approach is that by studying the human-adapted pathogen Mycobacterium tuberculosis, as well as the animal-adapted Mycobacterium bovis, by comparing those pathogens, can we understand what makes one of them an animal pathogen, the other a human pathogen? And by understanding that, can you expose the tricks and the tools that the pathogen is using to overcome host defenses to establish infection and ultimately cause disease? And so what we've been doing now for many years is using the ideas of genomics and comparative genomics to identify differences between those two bacteria, the human adapted pathogen versus the animal adapted pathogen. And then by identifying those differences, can we determine how they make those pathogens tick, basically, in their respective hosts? And one of the things that we've uncovered recently in a fantastic collaboration with Max Gutierrez and Chris Cavall and colleagues in the UK is showing how a particular protein that's produced at very high levels by Mycobacterium bovis, but at lower levels by Mycobacterium tuberculosis, is involved in the way that Mycobacterium bovis specifically interacts with the immune system of cattle and specifically interacts with a cell called a macrophage. So that when Mycobacterium bovis interacts with the bovine macrophage immune cell, the fact that it produces a high level of this protein seems to cause those macrophages to take on a particular morphology called a multinucleated giant cell. So it's altering the way those macrophages are working. And we think that that's an example of how these comparative analyses between human and animal pathogens can identify some specific tricks or methods that the pathogens are using to establish infection and then ultimately cause disease in, for example, the animal host in that regard. I think that's important because that particular protein as well, we know that there are different variants of the BCG vaccine strain. And some of those different variants produce different levels of that protein. So what we're thinking of is, I wonder if different variants of the BCG vaccine strain, therefore, would have different protective efficacies based on whether or not that protein is produced at high or low levels. So all of those analyses, I think, are really providing us with clues into the way that these pathogens have evolved and adapted over time to their respective hosts. So using these comparative genomic approaches or comparative approaches, we can start to uncover some of those tools that the bacteria is using, but also by doing so, uncover the targets that we'd be able to use to develop the next generation of vaccines or diagnostics to combat the infection.
And that is all that we have time for this month. I want to say thank you so much for listening, and a huge thanks to Professor Stephen Gordon for taking the time to speak with me for this episode. I will leave links to some of Stephen's research in the podcast description below, and please do visit our website to find out more about the Microbiology Society's Unlocking Potential Fund. I've been Laura, and thanks for listening to Microbe Talk.